Hi, everyone, and welcome to another monthly edition of the Student Press Law Center's podcast, an update on legal developments affecting the rights of those working in and around student media. The Student Press Law Center is an advocate for the First Amendment rights of those working in student journalism, and there's much more information about what we do and how you can get legal help on our website, splc.org. We hope you also follow us on social media. Twitter is at SPLC, and connect with us by using the SPLC at splc.org email line if you've got a question about your own legal rights. We're here talking with Jack Greiner, a media lawyer from Cincinnati, who has represented student journalists in a groundbreaking open government case that may prove to be a harbinger for other states. Dozens and dozens of college campuses around the country maintain police forces that look indistinguishable from city or county police, exercising the same level of governmental authority, including the power to arrest and even to use deadly force, but with one important distinction. When the campus is private, many of these institutions maintain that they need not obey the same public disclosure laws that would apply to a city or a county police force or even a police force at a public college or university. That's because state open records laws typically don't apply to the activities of private organizations. But there is change in the wind. Just since 2012, the law has evolved in three states to require greater disclosure on the part of police at private colleges: North Carolina, Texas, and, as our guest Jack Greiner will explain to us, Ohio as well, thanks to a case that he brought on behalf of a college student editor at Otterbein University, who, I might add, Anna Schiffbauer, was also an intern with us at the Student Press Law Center. Jack Greiner is a partner with the Graydon Head Law Firm. He's based in Cincinnati. He's a graduate of Notre Dame Law School. He's very eminent in the field of media law and has represented clients that include the Cincinnati Enquirer, ESPN, and many others in his career. He's been an advocate for open government and speaks and writes frequently on that subject. And we're really delighted to have him here joining us. So Jack, thanks for joining us, and thanks for your work on Anna Schiffbauer's case, which I would love for you to explain to the folks who are listening. If you don't mind, just kind of give us some setup on how that case came about.
Sure. I'm sitting here trying to remember exactly, but I recall talking to Hillary Warren, the faculty advisor at Otterbein, generally about the topic. I had a little bit of experience here in Cincinnati with Xavier University that maintained a police force, and we were attempting to get some records. And as I recall from that, we did not pursue litigation with Xavier, but I was generally familiar that private campuses had the ability to maintain police forces, and that they had the same kind of powers as public police forces. And so we were talking about it, and then Hillary mentioned that some of her student journalists were running into a little bit of a brick wall with Otterbein on incident reports that had to do with sexual assaults. And there was some concern, and I've seen this on other campuses, there was some concern that sexual assault complaints were being sort of shuffled off to the student disciplinary court and not really treated as crimes. And that was the concern of the Otterbein student newspaper, and they were just simply trying to get various incident reports from the Otterbein police force. And so we started talking about it, and when when Hillary was explaining to me the issue, it just occurred, it just seemed to me that this was ridiculous and it would be, a good time to challenge it. So we did, and the way you proceed in a public records dispute in Ohio is that you file what's called a petition for a writ of mandamus, and it gets the name, really, if you just think about it, essentially from the concept that you are mandating, or the court is mandating, that that another court do something that they're obligated to do, you know, i.e. follow the law. And so mandamus is just sort of a fancy name for that. You ask a higher court here to mandate that another public official follow the law. And in Ohio, you can initiate a mandamus suit as an original action if you choose to do so in the Ohio Supreme Court. You can also start it off. You can start it off at any of the levels of the courts, which would mean you could start in the trial section, the common pleas section, or you could start in the intermediate appellate level, or you can go ahead and just start it in the Ohio Supreme Court. The effect of starting it in the Ohio Supreme Court is that you cut off any appeals. It is kind of a one-shot deal at that point. In my view, when I think a case is probably going to wind up in the Ohio Supreme Court, I start in the Ohio Supreme Court. It tends to, you know, make the process go a little quicker. So that is what we did. We filed against the university, and we named a vice president of discipline, and we named the Otterbein police chief. Initially, the case was assigned the Ohio Supreme Court, and I don't really honestly know why they do this, but they have a habit or a practice that they've developed over the last few years of sending mandamus cases, public records cases, to their in-house mediation service. And I don't have a problem generally with the concept of mediation, and certainly if something can be worked out, that's great. What I find, though, is that these types of cases are, you know, very difficult, if not impossible, to work out, because there's just not a lot of room for common ground. I think I'm entitled to it. You think I'm not. How do we resolve that?
What would be the halfway point between yes and no?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't like I was satisfied with getting every other incident report or something. You know.
Sure.
This ultimately went as most cases do. However, Otterbein, I think, in an effort to just delay things, expressed much interest and optimism in the prospect of settling the case. I never shared that optimism, and I remained a little wary of their enthusiasm. But we did engage for several sessions in an effort to settle, and we, you know, were unable to do so. So the mediator finally agreed that we weren't going to get this case settled, and so she returned the case to the regular docket, meaning that the court could now rule on the case. I sent some discovery, and in fact asked for, I wanted to take the depositions of the police chief, because I wanted to get an understanding of how they operated, how they handled their documents, their incident reports, et cetera. And I got some resistance to that proposal, and we wound up not ever really resolving that issue, because the Supreme Court, much to my surprise, to be perfectly honest with you, wound up, and it was a pleasant surprise, but it granted, really, before we even got to the point of doing any discovery, it granted a peremptory writ of mandamus in our favor. Oh, I meant to add that once the case was returned to the regular docket, we got, in my estimation, a somewhat pleasant surprise in that the Ohio Attorney General asked to intervene in the case on our side.
Right.
So I was, I was pleasantly surprised by that development. I wasn't really counting on that. I had had some previous cases recently with the Attorney General on the other side, and I just did not get the impression that he was a real big public access advocate. But for whatever reason, they came in and filed on our behalf an amicus brief. So I think that helped quite a lot. And so then, as I said, before we got to the point of really even needing discovery, the Supreme Court issued a peremptory writ. And that's a kind of a significant word, peremptory. The peremptory writ under Ohio law means that, here, I just pulled it up just so I'd have it, when the right to require the performance of an act is clear and it is apparent that no valid excuse can be given for not doing it, a court may allow a peremptory mandamus. So what the Supreme Court really said was that Otterbein had no excuse for not providing these records, that it was absolutely clear that they were required to provide these records, which was, a pretty significant ruling and validated, I think, our position in a very real way.
Right.
So,
and just to get into the rationale for it, right? What one rationale that people typically urge in these type of cases where you have a private agency on the other side, an agency that doesn't directly receive its funding from the government, wasn't created by the government, but is doing a governmental function. Typically, the argument goes that these folks are operating as an arm or an extension of the government, or doing so under such close government supervision that they've essentially been deputized as agents or an extension of the government. And that's sort of the route that you elected to take, right?
Somewhat. There's some bad law in Ohio on that. The Ohio Supreme Court in 2009 adopted something that they call the functional equivalence test. And it is it's a test that is applied when a private entity takes on the duties of a public entity. And it's a four-factor test, and the problem with it is that it almost guarantees it almost, in my mind, guarantees that the records will be deemed private rather than public. And I say that for this reason. The four factors are: does the government primarily fund the operation? And typically, it does. Another, the case in which the Supreme Court came up with the functional equivalence test was a case where a private operator ran a county prison. So, I mean, a county prison is obviously a public function. So that part of the test was easily satisfied. And then the question is, the first question is it a public function? So, again, a county prison is clearly a public function. And then the next question is, how is it funded? And frequently it is indeed funded by tax dollars. But then the third question is, does the public entity retain day-to-day control over the operation? And the answer to that typically is no. I mean, that's kind of why the public entity, outsources it. And then the last question is, was this done simply to avoid the Public Records Act? And again, the answer usually is no. I mean, because that is not the primary purpose typically. It's typically to save a little money, et cetera. So, and then the court says that the requesting party, for some reason, has to satisfy the functional equivalency test by clear and convincing evidence. And the problem is, it usually winds up a 2-2 tie. Usually you
can sure.
establish that it's a public function and that the public entity is paying for it. But, you know, more often than not, the public entity doesn't retain day-to-day control, and it's not set up solely to evade the Public Records Act. So it's almost like playing tic-tac-toe. I mean, it winds up in a tie most of the time. And since the Supreme Court decided that the requesting party had the clear and convincing duty, you know, the requesting party winds up losing. So I had to face that. And Otterbein, you know, pushed that position pretty hard that the functional equivalency test applied. My counter argument was that this was a case where that didn't apply because the functional equivalency test occurs when a public entity delegates to a private entity. My argument was here that in fact the private entity was delegating to the public entity. So it was a different situation, and one in which the functional equivalency test had no bearing. And the Supreme Court, you know, essentially agreed with my argument there. And you know, what I think the Supreme Court really decided, and what motivated the Supreme Court to rule the way they did, was just the fact that, look, this is the ultimate state power that these people are exercising. When you can deprive someone of their life and their liberty and or their liberty, you are exercising state power, and you can't do that behind closed doors. And you have to be transparent about that. The records of how that power is used have to be available for public inspection. And I think it really just came down to somewhat of a common sense kind of ruling, but I think it was justified by the statute, because this, you know, if Otterbein wanted to keep these records private, you know, they could have done that. They simply could have maintained a private security force. They opted to set up a police force that had police powers, and so, you know, they just weren't. They couldn't have it both ways, and I think they were kind of trying to have it both ways. They wanted the power of the state with the privacy of a private institution, and I just don't think the Ohio Supreme Court was willing to let them, you know, get away with that.
Right. Well, 2 points. First of all, we should mention that in addition to Ohio, Texas has now joined the club of requiring private institutions to disclose the reports of police activity by virtue of a state legislative enactment, one that was motivated by a particular episode at Rice University in the district of an influential state senator who found the police's refusal to turn over records about an arrest to be particularly outrageous and decided to fix that legislatively. And also in 2012, North Carolina joined the club after a lawsuit that was initiated by a college journalist in that state who was frustrated in his inability to get police reports from Elon University. I should also mention right. that we are talking in each of these instances about really core documents about the performance of police business. That is that incident report or that arrest report, the narrative write-up that an officer generates when called to the scene of a crime that would explain the who, what, where, and when of what happened. And those really are the bread and butter of effective police reporting. Without access to that incident report, the journalist would have no idea, for instance, whether the person who was stopped for drunk driving on the campus might be the quarterback of the football team or the president of student government or somebody else whose arrest is newsworthy. They would have very little way of knowing for what reason police are arresting people and whether they're using that arrest power responsibly or not. And I guess
right. And I think also the other point that's important here is that you know there's a lot of competition for students among colleges, and mm-hmm. I think that students, incoming students, prospective students, and their parents want to know what the what kind of safety situation they're getting themselves into. You know, what is the environment like? And I think if those records can be maintained in secret, then the college is university is better able to obscure the facts, hide the facts about, you know, what the real situation is. And I think that, you know, that's just really untenable. And frankly, I mean, I think just from a fairness perspective, the state universities can't because they're public entities. And so I think there's just sort of a fairness kind of thing here in terms of putting the private universities and the state universities on kind of equal footing in terms of reporting and disclosing, you know, police activity on campus.
Well, I should mention the name of the case for those who are interested in looking it up and doing further research is Schiffauer versus Banaszak. It is a decision issued by the Supreme Court of Ohio on May 21st, 2015. I guess, Jack, just with the couple minutes that we have left now, even though the journalists at Otterbein are now armed with this excellent ruling from the Ohio Supreme Court, that hasn't necessarily been the end of the story, right? It's not necessarily the case that even when a court directs an institution to comply with state disclosure laws, that journalists get immediate and complete compliance.
Yeah, Otterbein, for whatever reason, they're still they drag their feet a little bit in terms of providing the records. They said they were studying, you know, the application of FERPA, which FERPA does not apply. I mean, very clearly, FERPA says it doesn't apply to law enforcement records. And defines law enforcement records in a way that I think unquestionably covers these records. And now they started expressing concern over the Violence Against Women Act, which is a federal statute, which I've looked at it, and again, I don't see any duty or obligation that arises under that statute to that would require Otterbein or permit Otterbein to withhold these records. And yet, even when they finally turned them over, they went ahead and redacted a lot of material on them. So we're gonna. Yeah, the case remains. We're also still in front of the Supreme Court on my request for attorney's fees in a mandamus case. If public office is required to turn over the records, then the statute provides for an attorney fee recovery to the requesting party. So we do have that going on, and we may have to get in front of the court again on this issue of the redactions. But we're just kind of still looking at that and trying to make a decision about the proper way to go.
Well, I'm hopeful that others will take inspiration from your success in Ohio. There was a failed legislative attempt to add Illinois to the list of states requiring disclosure of private universities, and there's some talk of trying to bring that bill back again next year. It certainly seems like your case provides, in some respects, a roadmap for litigators to follow in future states, understanding that every state's law and the tests applied by their courts might be a little bit different. Just in the minute or so left, any closing thoughts on this issue and maybe where you see this going, if you think that we can look forward to more progress and that other states will fall off the line?
Well, I hope so. There was a setback a little bit in Indiana where ESPN filed suit to get similar records from Notre Dame, and so far Notre Dame has prevailed. But again, it illustrates a point that not every state's exactly the same. And as I read that opinion in the Notre Dame case, the initial opinion, it seemed to focus on just sort of the very strict reading of the statute. So every state's going to be different. And, it may take legislation in some states. It may take court action in others. But I think it's important. And I think that, I think students, parents, members of the community have a right to know what police are doing. When police have the power to deprive someone of their life or liberty, that needs to be done in as transparent a fashion as possible. And I think that just makes sense to people. So hopefully, as we go forward, we'll see more and more states fall in line here.
Well, that ESPN case in Indiana is, in fact, on appeal right now. It's in front of the State Court of Appeal, and we have some optimism that we may see a reversal there. If you're interested in following that case or any developments about the law of public access on campus, we hope that you'll subscribe to our news alerts at splc.org, follow us on social media, and give us a call if you have any question about your legal rights. I want to thank Jack Greiner of the Graydon Head Law Firm in Cincinnati for his work on behalf of college journalists, and in particular for his work on the Schiffbauer case and for joining us today. So thanks, Jack, and we'll look forward to what we hope is a successful resolution on the attorney fee issue and the redaction issue there as well. Thanks for joining us on the Student Press Law Center podcast. Please join us next month for another update about legal developments affecting the rights of student journalists and the advisors who work with them. Thanks for listening.